John, I'm still visible. You
Yes.
can, okay, thank you. Well, thanks everyone. Good afternoon. As I said, today's talk and our class are about the third pure precept. But before I take up that precept specifically, I just wanted to say a little bit about the pure precepts generally, and to say a tiny bit about the way the 16 precepts are organized. After we take refuge, which are the first three precepts, come the pure precepts: avoid evil, do good, benefit all beings. These three pure precepts are like a map of Buddha's mind, or as Reb Anderson puts it, the shape of Buddha's mind. They're an overview, a bird's eye view of how the awakened heart or mind lives in the world, the structure and the fundamental design of the enlightened mind. And then this then is further elaborated in the 10 grave precepts. So, number one, avoid evil, or avoid action that leads to attachment or that furthers the separation of self and others. Number two, act on opportunities to do good in your life. And then number three, the third pure precept. Here are a few ways that this precept is articulated. The first is the original version found in the Pali Canon, purify the mind. And this emphasizes the theme, which was emphasized in early Buddhism, of finding nirvana for oneself. In Zen, however, in Zen Buddhist practice, purity, as in purify the mind, is equated with non-duality. So for us, the meaning of purity is to emphasize that we live in connection with others, that indeed there is no self and other, and there is no liberation until all beings are liberated. There is only connection, relationship, and meeting, as we learned through Norman that Martin Buber has said. A few other versions of this third precept. I vow to live for the benefit of all being. I vow to act with others always in mind. I vow to live for and with all beings. And I vow to live and be lived. I vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all being. This last one having is said to have been Suzuki Roshi's favorite way of expressing the precept. I've been thinking a lot about this last version of the precept, to live and be lived for the benefit of all being or all beings. To live and be lived, this attitude toward our lives is found in many Buddhist teachings and is really crucial, I think. We find it again and again in many ways and places in the teachings. One of them is the fourth of the Bodhisattva vows. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. And Dogen writes of what he calls self-fulfilling and self-receiving samadhi or concentration, self-receiving samadhi or concentration as being vital to a true understanding of practice. And Genjo Koan, one of Dogen's central texts, has these lines: conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things approaching and carrying out practice enlightenment is realization. Usually in our lives, we take our ideas and desires and move through life, trying to keep things under the control of the self so that our life is stable and peaceful and we get what we want. The alternative attitude suggested here by Dogen is that of allowing all things to approach, that is to allow to that is to receive our own thoughts and emotions and sensations, as well as receiving all of the input of other people and other beings of the whole universe, and allowing these things to practice in our own bodies and minds. This is the attitude that's fostered by our practice of zazen, sitting still and being the recipient. We give our attention to all of the myriad dharmas and realize and actualize our connection to everything. Dogen's formulation here emphasizes that an awakened way of being in the world versus a deluded way of being has to do with relationship, with how we relate to the world and to other people and beings, that life is indeed relationship, and that we don't have any existence really outside of our relationship with others. In his book, Being Upright, Reb Anderson tells us that this precept is also translated as embrace and sustain all beings. And he tells us that the Chinese character that's translated as embrace and sustain conveys a kind of active and passive and active-passive dynamic. He tells us that the character for embrace and sustain has one element that is the pictographic character, which is the symbol for hand, as in actively giving a hand. And then in the character, there are three symbols for ear, implying passive or receptive listening. Reb encourages us to consider being three quarters observant and one quarter actively helpful. Listening, observing carefully helps us to be truly helpful. The character also implies that we both do the embracing and sustaining, and that we are simultaneously embraced and sustained. An important point. By practicing this precept, we awaken to the reality that life is the space between us, that living selfishly really only brings suffering to us, and that benefiting others, as we all know, brings us ease and joy. Also, when we are awake to awakening and see that we are nothing without everyone, our practice naturally spills over into helping and nurturing all people and beings. The converse is also true. The practice, the activity of helping others, even when we might not feel fully on board with it, even when we might not really feel in our hearts and minds fully on board, even then, the practice of helping others changes us because mind and body are not separate. When we sit zazen, we're fully in accord and with absolute truth. And when we're not sitting, when we're in our daily lives, we have the precepts to guide the actions of body, speech, and mind. And following all of the precepts, starting with this one, as in today's discussion, following the precepts changes us gradually from the outside in, you might say. A couple of days ago, the New York Times ran the obituary of someone named Ron O'Brien, age 86, who was a renowned, highly successful coach for decades of Olympic divers, including Greg Louganis. Another one of his gold medal divers, Mary Ellen Clark, said this of Ron O'Brien. He would do one-on-one meetings to learn how to motivate people, what was inside them, how they learned, and he had the ability to tap into people's inner talents. This indeed is allowing all things to approach and practice within the self. And when we meet with Zen teachers under the best of circumstances, and people often said this was true of Suzuki Roshi, we feel fully seen and accepted for who we really are. Allowing others to be themselves is a great gift if we can give it. We practice giving this gift by learning to open the hand of thought, to let go of our selfish concerns and our karmic entanglements. This learning, this practice of letting go, is Buddha's activity. It is not something we practice in order to become Buddha. I often go for a swim in the mornings, soon after morning zazen, and sometimes the concentration of the sitting carries over. I find I may not listen to the radio in the car, but just drive attentively. I park and walk down the street, feeling my legs and body while walking, being receptive to the light and the sounds, the quality of the air, the color in the trees and the grass alongside. And when I reach the front desk at the pool and meet the gaze of the young person there to check me in, there's often a natural, quite ordinary, and quite wonderful feeling of connection as we smile at each other and wish each other a good day. We give each other the mutual gift of our good wishes, and I feel his smile and good wishes, and I also feel good for having given mine. This practice of presence and attention overflows naturally into nurturing, friendly, helpful attitudes toward others. And this is a very small example. We take care of our lives by paying meticulous attention to the concrete details of our daily life, and then we may notice and take up the many invitations and opportunities for connection and appreciation. We have many ways to benefit, to give gifts to self and others. Completely investing our life energy in being a carpenter, a cook, secretary, teacher, this is very much giving our gift to the world. Caring for our garden, our children, our parents, our friends, these are our gifts. Donating to political causes we believe in, giving a word of Dharma, smiling kindly at someone we pass on the street, there's really no end to the gifts we give and receive, and no separation between giver, receiver, and gift. I'm going to end with a short poem, a favorite of mine. Many of you may know it, by William Stafford, about the present moment. Starting here, what do you want to remember? How sunlight creeps along a shining floor? What scent of old wood hovers? What softened sound from outside fills the air? Will you ever bring a better gift for the world than the breathing respect that you carry with you wherever you go right now? Are you waiting for time to show you some better thoughts? When you turn around, starting here, lift this new glimpse that you found. Carry into evening all that you want from this day, this interval that you spent reading or hearing this. Keep it for life. What can anyone give you greater than now, starting here, right in this room, when you turn around? We take care of our lives. We benefit ourselves when we pay attention to the breathing respect, the gift that is ours alone and our responsibility to bring to the world. And the world gives us back, as the poet says, this new glimpse that changes us, that we carry forward when we turn around and pass it along. Thank you, everyone, for your attention. I think we'll take a moment just to sit. And now, John, if you'd like to speak to us, please.
Thank you, Michael. So, good evening, everybody. Nice to see you all. Let me put the group view on so I'm not staring at myself. There you are. Okay, so tonight I'm going to be speaking on the vow, I vow to live for the benefit of all beings. Well, this vow pretty much includes all of Zen practice, doesn't it? I mean, it is our very Bodhisattva vow. You know, it's central to all of our Zen teachings and all our Zen precepts. And it's the same vow that we chant daily in our practice, vowing to save all beings. They're the same vow. As I recall, when I came to Zen practice originally, it was basically to heal myself, to address the void and persistent nagging that there was more to my life than I was living, and perhaps a certain unhappiness about who or what I was. Yet somehow, over all these years of Zen practice, I slowly changed to the realization that this practice is much, much bigger than me, beyond me, because this practice includes everything and everyone. We often talk about this as interconnectedness, but in essence, it is that we all share Buddha nature with all beings. Basically, we are all beings. The beauty of this interconnectedness and Buddha nature of all things can't but open the heart. If I am the left hand, how can I not but love the right hand that is you? And in knowing this, we come to understand that no one is truly saved until all beings are saved. And that is our true and ultimate Bodhisattva vow. So, although we may enter practice for ourselves, we come to realize, again, we are really not here for ourselves. We are Bodhisattvas that are training ourselves to help and heal others to embrace their own path, their own true Buddha nature. We practice for the world. Simply put, we are saving ourselves to save all beings. You help inspire me to be a better person and spread awakening. I inspire you. We all inspire each other. We are all growing our awareness and capacity to wake up together. By our simple practice of deep sitting and silence with one another. To me, this is not a teaching as much as a becoming that we intimately share together. By finding our own goodness and light within, we shine it out into the world in this profound intention to benefit all beings. What could possibly be more meaningful or more fulfilling? And yet this benefiting all beings right here in our everyday actions of humility and effort is really an unremarkable practice, an unremarkable enlightenment, as Norman shared with us on our last all-day sitting when he said, every moment of walking, sitting, eating, sleeping, speaking, listening, standing up, sitting down, living, dying is enlightenment. And he questions us, am I living my life as truly and lovingly as possible? Part of our problem to grasp how to benefit all beings is our belief that we are insignificant in the greater scheme of things. But that too is a delusion and too small-minded. The karmic effects of our actions are incalculable. The meaning of our own lives is incomprehensible. I think this small-mindedness stunts us on some level, like the way we shut down when we hear absurdly large numbers. Last week, Neil deGrasse, the famed astrologist, was interviewing, saying that the known universe has grown to over a trillion galaxies. Last time I heard it was a billion, a trillion galaxies, that there are so many trillions and trillions of stars that they are more than all the grains of sand on our entire Earth. I mean, just think of that. When I hear these astounding numbers that I cannot grasp or comprehend, I feel my mind drifting and unbelieving. Yet this is true. Absolutely, scientifically true. But it is I who disengage. So, what harm would it be to consider our incomprehensible lives and positive intentions and acts as a blessing, a gift, an offering, an embrace to no one in particular or to no end point? But an intention of healing and benefiting others. This is not a sacrifice or burden, but an unfolding of our own true Buddha nature. Here it is a gift, an offering, the wink of an eye, an embrace. I want to be an instrument of happiness and comfort to others, to benefit others. Yet I'm mindful of all my crazy habits and judgments and moodiness that gets in the way. And that is okay, because I am just trying to live my vow the best I can in my imperfect way. And as Sangha, we do this together. Each of us is a manifestation of Buddha in our own mysterious way. Born through the beauty and struggles of our lives and our own individual karmas. This is why the Lotus Sutra paradoxically tells us there are no beings to be saved. No one is saved as much as return to who they truly are. We are simply returning to the Buddha nature we have always been and always will be if we are willing to let it in. Recently, I spoke with Kathy Fisher on this precept of benefiting all beings. She helped me see another more feminine view of this practice, grandmother mind. She spoke of how raising children and teaching young students requires patience, particularly when they are acting out. In those periods, little could be done and a timeout was needed to rebalance before anything else could come in. Telling them their faults or judging them only heightened bad behavior. But patiently, in time, with trust and empathy, they could take in the positive modeling she was trying to teach them. This slow, deliberate process, this patient practice and modeling, feels like the simple, everyday beneficial actions we are trying to cultivate in our precepts practice to benefit others. In 2010, when traveling to Dogen's Eheiji Temple in Japan with Norman and his priests and senior students, Suzuki Roshi's son, Huitsu, spoke to us on the same grandmother mind as overwhelming kindness, compassion, and empathy, being selfless and offering unconditional love and support. So how then does our precept practice help us in this practice to benefit all beings? I like to think of our precept practice as the alignment of our actions and conduct with the deepest teachings of our Zen practice, evidenced by our everyday actions in the world. But I wonder if this is truly enough, whether something more than action, akin to intention, might also be worth considering. Like Kathy's intention of patience and modeling, the difference of an offering being a sacrifice or a gift lies in the intention. When I was writing my precepts years ago, I found I needed to add a few more precepts to give voice to my own intentions. I vowed for embracing compassion, kindness, listening, loving, forgiving, abandoning attachments, seeing delusion, honoring others' Buddha nature, embracing death as an act of love and compassion. I may not steal or lie or kill, but am I generous, kind, caring? Implied in our precepts must be the development of these deeply embedded virtues of our practice. I have focused on the intention of kindness to guide my personal practice for many years, to overcome triggering some of my negative emotions, defensiveness, anger, projection, all of which I'm guilty of. Norman made kindness part of my Dharma name, Ki Rei Go Jin, resolute effort awakened by kindness. I know kindness is one of my Dharma gates that I need to continuously focus on to soften my emotions and open my heart. And intention helps. Lately, I came across writings on a field of virtue ethics, which goes back as far as the ancient Greeks. Rather than moral ethics, which assess duties or consequences of actions, virtue ethics examines character. It asks, instead of asking, what is the right thing to do? It asks, what kind of person should I be? This is an important distinction because it can be entirely possible to act ethically yet not incorporate the deeper meaning intended in those actions, such as being a kind person takes the outward actions of being kind, but being a truly kind person takes an inner wisdom developed over multitudes of kind actions. Our numerous actions of being kind change us in natural to naturally becoming a truly kind person. Plato and especially Aristotle spoke heavily on virtue. For Aristotle, virtues are acquired by doing. This is important. We have to do them to be them, like acting kindly until we're reliably kind. Spiritual practice is extremely helpful for forming virtues because spiritual practice is the domain in which we look deeply into and practice habits of thinking and feeling. Our characters change through our repetitive practices, guiding us to benefit all beings. There is no precept to be compassionate or to be loving or to be mindful. Yet the virtue of our practice is our constant training, our continuous practice to be, really be compassionate, loving, and mindful, and much more. In other words, to be virtuous. Our Zazen together, I feel, is a tangible, physically and spiritually connected lifeline of support for each other in developing the confidence that we can be the loving, compassionate, mindful beings we truly are. Building character often requires doing hard things. The Greeks emphasized this in difficult sports. Doing hard things helps develop courage and self-confidence that we really can do this. Yet after a while, Zazen or Shishin isn't really so hard. Being kind or compassionate isn't really so hard once we more become it. Not perfectly, of course, far from it, far from it. Yet even if we can occasionally take on these virtues, we really can benefit all beings in an intimate, direct way that should need no words or strenuous effort, just being. I am a person of habit, surrounded by others I learn. By doing I learn. We are all each other's guide in this. The elder's silent teaching, the gleam in the eye or the smile, the face-to-face transmission one to the other among all of us. Another teaching of virtue ethics that may differ from moral ethics is how one sees emotions. Aristotle saw emotions as central to good life. He believed that moral virtues involved appropriate, balanced emotional responses and warned against emotional extremes. Emotions are not inviolable experiences or beyond reproach. That if something feels right, it must be right. Clearly, that isn't right, because we all get into a lot of trouble with this. Oh, it felt so right. I mean, no. Emotional wisdom is an essential part of virtue, and that we can learn to balance our emotions, to find calm while in distress, peace in chaos, etc. To help develop this in character and to balance aggressiveness, the Greeks recommended studying and writing poetry. A hats off to Norman. So sports and poetry became mainstays of education and virtuous practice. Spiritual practice does promote virtuous practice. And there are many, many virtues, gentleness, charity, fair-mindedness. And virtuous practice is not defined by any one or set of virtues per se. But my sense is all virtues are advanced just as all moral ethics are advanced by our intention and continuous practice. So going back to the basics, how might this help in our practice to, instead of asking what is the right thing to do, to ask what kind of person should I be? For me, it helps diminish the ego. It is not I determining what is right in a particular action. It sounds egotistical that I can forgive another's actions, that I know better, that they are wrong. But if I come from the viewpoint of being a compassionate person, I can feel another's pain and suffering enough to perhaps understand and have empathy for them, even if forgiveness is not possible. And of course, it cannot be forced into a situation. Vowing to benefit all beings is likely the broadest intention I can think of, and yet the most profound. It is our practice. So for me, I can rest assured that my own simple life of just showing up, just sitting, just going on with my everyday life with humility and effort, to intend to benefit others is enough, more than enough. It is the unremarkable practice of awakening that Norman spoke of. As he said, every moment is enlightenment. Like Dongshan's enlightenment poem, when seeing his reflection in the stream. Now I go on alone, but everywhere I meet it. It is now me. I am not it. Now I go on alone, but everywhere I meet it. It is now me. So thank you for listening, and thank you for your practice. So now we'll just have a moment of silence, and then we'll deal with the Q&A side of things. So now, Michael and I will give you a question for the breakout rooms, and John has been kind enough to manage the breakout rooms for us. So, Michael, would you like to go with your question first?
Sure. I've just been thinking about how we, all of us, give and receive gifts to each other constantly. I think maybe everybody in their lives does that, and all of us here certainly concentrating on developing our intention to save and be saved by the world, give gifts and receive them. So I thought maybe it would be good to just think about that with each other. What are the gifts? What are some of the gifts, large and small, that you give and receive in your lives? And maybe how does that feel to you? Something like that. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And my question is simply, how do you see your everyday practice, benefiting all beings? Is there a connection? Do you feel it? Do you see it? That's it. So now we're going to have Jean is going to be handling the breakout rooms.
John, do you want to stop the recording now?
Yes, thank you.